From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, anemic state funding and fewer students. Challenging times for Michigan's public universities.
There are 15 public universities in the state. Only four have had even a 1% increase in enrollment over the past decade.
She lost her son at Sandy Hook. Now she's partnering with the University of Michigan to form a National Center for School Safety and help schools respond to gun violence.
Everything has changed since Sandy Hook. It's perhaps on a slower timeline than I would like and that a lot of other people would like, but it has been incremental change, and that is progress towards the bigger changes that we need to do.
And the Kirtland's warbler off the endangered species list.
The strategy and the recovery plan was to hit 1,000 singing males, and we're over 2,000 singing males as of this year.
Hello there, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Later on today's program, we'll talk about the no-tip restaurant trend that is spreading in southeast Michigan. But first, the new budget Governor Whitmer signed gives Michigan's public universities $1.47 billion for the new fiscal year. Now, take that and adjust it for inflation, and here's the deal. Public university funding from the state is dropping. Bridge Magazine's Ron French reports this is just one more problem that some Michigan public universities are wrestling with, along with shrinking enrollment. Ron French, you say this is a perfect storm for Michigan universities. How so?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me here. Well, first of all, there are fewer high school graduates. Our birth rate in Michigan is the lowest it's been in since 1944. So there are fewer students that are graduating from high school looking to go to college. And also the college-going rate is down even among those students because the economy is good and people can find jobs. And I think, do we really want to go to college for 4 years or just go out and work with my dad? You combine that with the fact that state support for public universities is, when you take inflation into account, lower. And some of these universities are really in a pickle.
So give us an idea of which of Michigan's public universities is feeling this pressure and which are not.
There are 15 public universities in the state. Only four have had even a 1% increase in enrollment over the past decade. Six of them have had double-digit decreases. Central Michigan, one of the biggest universities in the state, their enrollment is down 21% in a decade. Eastern Michigan, 18%. Saginaw Valley, 18%. Northern Michigan, 19%. Lake Superior State, down 14%. So it's really hitting some of our biggest name universities really hard.
Now, I know from your piece, University of Michigan, Michigan State, U of M, DeWitt, they're kind of exempt from this. They're doing okay as far as increasing the headcount and increasing.
Right. The flagships universities are doing fine. But everyone knows them, and so they got the big sports teams. And so when these students have a choice, and they have more choices now than they did, they end up going to one of those two universities.
But golly gee, when you think of all this long list of institutions with the with enrollment down, it still costs the same to run those institutions, doesn't it?
Yeah, if you have three fewer English majors, you can't get rid of an English professor, you still have to have the lights on in the English department. So really, the base costs. It's hard to decrease those costs at the same rate that you're losing enrollment.
So what's the answer?
And so the answer has to be they raise tuition.
And then you have fewer people saying, I want to go.
Exactly. And the higher the price are, the more people say, I think I'll just go straight into the workforce.
What you describe, Ron, sounds like a dog chasing its tail.
I know. It's very tough. And this isn't just a Michigan problem. Mm-hmm. It's happening nationally, both because of lower birth rates. And also because, and it seems odd to say this, but because the economy is doing well, when the economy does well, university enrollment usually goes down. Mm. Because people think they can make a living without accruing this kind of debt.
Yes. The other thing that I thought was interesting as I looked at your piece in Bridge, Ron, was there is kind of a political tinge where there's this belief among some that universities are liberal bastions that are hostile to conservative thought, and that's actually keeping some students away?
Right. If you look at polling, you'll find that the attitudes, there are greater negative attitudes about universities in rural areas. And oddly enough, that is where you actually need more people to attend college to turn the economy around. But yeah, what happens is the attitudes for between Republicans and Democrats about higher education were the same until 2016. What happened that year? Well, what now you see a complete split in that, and there's a large majority of Republicans in polling who do not see universities as a positive in American society.
So what are the implications for the state of having fewer Michiganders in college?
Well, that's the thing. We have leaders in the state who rightly are saying we have to increase the number of adults with some sort of post-high school degree or certificate.
Just point at what happened with the Amazon headquarter bid.
That's the perfect example. Yeah. They didn't come here. We didn't make the cut to be a finalist because we didn't have enough talent. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we have trouble attracting businesses. And when people get degrees, they often leave the state. So we're 31st in the country in the percentage of adults with a high school degree, and unshockingly, we're 33rd in median income. So when you look at those numbers, you say you need more people with college degrees. Well, but we're not doing that, and the result of that is going to be that we're going to have a trouble turning around our economy.
So. Is anyone talking about solutions to this perfect storm for these schools that are seeing the declining enrollment?
A lot of the solutions that you hear have to do, frankly, with more investment. And I know that people then often like turn off the radio when they hear that. But the fact is, we're 44th in the nation in per capita investment in higher education. Even if you don't want to give more money to the universities, the state could increase the amount of financial aid for students going mm-hmm. to college. That way you're not giving to these universities that you think are fat, but you're saying, here's additional scholarship money for good kids who want to go to school and want to get an education. Right now, they're not doing that. Some of these universities are likely going to have to adjust to being smaller than they've been. Mm-hmm. Central Michigan was 26,000 kids. They're at 21 now. They may have to adjust to being that size in the future. The demographics are not going to turn around in the near future.
Ron French, you will find his piece on this perfect storm Michigan universities are facing by going to bridgemi.com. It's always great to talk with you, Ron. Thank you.
Thank you.
A song of celebration. This week, the Kirtland's warbler was removed from the endangered species list. The yellow-breasted songbird rebounded from near extinction in Michigan. Dan Kennedy is the endangered species coordinator for the Michigan DNR. I spoke with him last year as the species was rebounding.
The Kirtland's warbler was first discovered in the United States in 1851 in Ohio, and then later, around 1900, it was discovered that its primary nesting area occurs in the northern lower Michigan, and it nests in areas where there's that are dominated by jack pine, and specifically young jack pine.
Okay, and then I hear it winters in the Bahamas.
Yeah, lucky bird.
lucky bird.
Yeah, the primary area is the Bahamas, but there are a few other islands in the Caribbean where researchers are now looking to see if there aren't some other islands it spends the winter on.
I want to talk about the threats to the Kirtland's warbler, and you kind of touched on this. These birds are really, really fussy about where they will nest. Tell us about the kind of tree this bird must have.
Yeah, I mentioned that a little earlier. They have very specific habitat needs for nesting, and they like very young jack pine between the ages of 5 and 20 years old. And that's when the branches are low and close to the ground, and they tend to nest up under some grass cover on the ground underneath those branches. And that, around the turn of the century in 1900, that habitat was pretty abundant because of some of the logging that was going on in the 1880s and 1890s and created some open areas and a lot of young jack pine. And so did some of our historic wildfires. Jack pine regenerates. Typically would have regenerated through wildfire.
Now, there's also the brown-headed cowbird. What does that do to the Kirtland's warbler nest?
Yeah, so along with habitat, the second primary threat is parasitism by brown-headed cowbirds. And what they would do is they lay their eggs in the nest of Kirtland's warblers, and then the young end up taking over and kicking the other eggs or young birds out of the nest, and so that they're the only ones left. And it had a major impact on the number of Kirtland's warbler young that were being successfully reared.
How low did the Kirtland's warbler population go in Michigan? How did it bottom out, and when was that?
Well, let me first say that the population is counted by the number of singing males. So in the first annual census was conducted in 1951. There was another one in 61. And then by 1971, it hit about 200 singing males. And researchers assume that there's an equal proportion of males and females, so the population was around 400. And in 1974 and 1987, there was a total of 167 singing males that were counted.
And what turned things around?
Right around in the 70s, when that 1971 census was completed, the DNR, Forest Service, and Fish and Wildlife Service got together a Kirtland's Warbler Advisory Committee. And then shortly following that, in 1973, the Endangered Species Act was signed, and the Kirtland's Warbler was one of the animal species listed. And so what happened from that was that those agencies and other organizations got together to start talking about what do we need to do to help this bird.
So what is the lesson here in the fact that this once threatened species of bird is rebounding and is surpassed your goals?
So I would say there's several lessons. And, you know, as the endangered species coordinator, what I've learned is patience. It takes time to recover an endangered species. The second thing I've learned is the collaboration amongst state, federal, NGOs, and industry is critical. And then also the third component is that connection with the public, the making sure that we're communicating and have an outreach program that effectively reaches the people of northern lower Michigan to keep them engaged on what we're doing.
Dan Kennedy, Endangered Species Coordinator for the Michigan DNR, with a success story of the Kirtland's Warbler. Thank you so much for being with us, Dan.
Thanks, Cindy.
And coming up, we mark the anniversary of a landmark civil rights case that happened in Michigan. That's next here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with help from our partners at the Michigan History Center. This week marks the anniversary of a very important case in Michigan history, Ferguson v. Guise. This case, coupled with the hard work of attorney D. Augustus Straker, made huge steps in advancing civil rights in 19th century Michigan. Joining us to talk about this is the president of the D. Augustus Straker Bar Association, Kimberly Ann Ward, and one of the original founders of this bar association. He also sits on the Wayne County Probate Court, Judge Terrence A. Keith. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Kimberly, I want to start with you. Tell us about this case. What was Ferguson versus Guy about?
So this is a very significant case, which is considered the Great Michigan Civil Rights Case. And it's significant for us specifically as a bar association for several reasons. One is because the bar association was named after David Augustus Straker, who is the attorney that handled the case. He was the first African-American to appear before the Michigan Supreme Court, and he appeared before the Michigan Supreme Court arguing this case that we're talking about today. And thank you so much for recognizing this case on the anniversary of the decision.
Absolutely. So what happened to William Ferguson?
So in the case of Ferguson v. Guise, Ferguson actually entered into a Detroit restaurant attempting to have a meal, a lunch meal. And he was seated of his own volition. He actually was not served. So the wait staff refused to serve him. He spoke to the manager, requested service. The manager advised that the wait staff was correct in refusing service because they required him to sit in a separate section, which was considered the colored section.
And what year was this? When did this happen?
So this was in 1890.
Okay. So it's a story that certainly echoes things that we heard throughout the 20th century. It reminds me of the lunch counter protests in 1960. So what happened, Judge Keith, the lead attorney, D. Augustus Straker? What did he argue?
Well, he put several things in context, and the significance of the case should be looked at in the context, because he really argued an equal protection argument, suggesting that one race cannot be treated differently than the other. And bear in mind that from a historical context, in 1857, you had the Dred Scott decision saying that blacks had no rights that a white man need recognize, followed by the 15th Amendment being adopted, giving black folks the rights under the Constitution. And then more significantly, the state of Michigan in 1885 had adopted a provision guaranteeing the rights of all people, regardless of race, equal protection under the laws. So this case before the Supreme Court in 1890 was the first case brought under the newly adopted provision of the state of Michigan, as well as the 15th Amendment. And so Straker made the argument, essentially, that under the equal protection provision that was just adopted by the state of Michigan 5 years earlier, and this being the first case brought to the Michigan Supreme Court, that Ferguson was being denied equal protection of his right to access the restaurant to be served. The restaurant was trying to make a distinction that one side of the restaurant was equal to the other in terms of service. But this was really the first case and the first major statement of the Supreme Court adopting and recognizing the equal protection provision.
Because the fact that we're saying that means that that he won.
Correct.
That he
Correct.
Won. And boy, I stop and I think that, guys, was 64 years before Brown v. Board of Education, which is the case that is kind of seen as launching the modern civil rights era. Why is it that this case, guys, has been somewhat overlooked in the 129 years since this decision?
Well, the Guy's case was a Michigan Supreme Court case. It was absolutely ahead of its time. So our Michigan Supreme Court really did set the pace and the trend for all the other Supreme Court's decisions within the United States. One thing that our Supreme Court justice mentioned in his ruling was that there must be absolute unconditional equality of white and colored men before the law. That was the language that he used. And he stated that there can be no separation in public places between people on account of their color alone. That ruling was quite significant, as Judge Keith just mentioned, and in reference to equal protection under the law, and the arguments being also with the 13th Amendment and the 14th Amendment as well. However, Brown versus Board of Education was, as you mentioned, 64 years later, that was a United States Supreme Court case.
We tend to think of racial issues, civil rights cases, on a national level, as opposed to a statewide concern. We tend to identify the racial issues by the decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, Plessy versus Ferguson, which came down just 6 years after, pretty much supplanted the significance, in one sense, of what the Michigan Supreme Court had held.
In the exact opposite direction, didn't it?
Absolutely. Yes.
Separate but equal, yeah.
Correct.
But as you say, when it's done on this state level, then that takes the state. Did that put Michigan kind of in the forefront of a civil rights movement in this country?
At the time, yes, because it came at the time when the doctrine of separate but equal was emerging rapidly through the states, which began essentially in South Carolina. But there was a case just prior to the Guy's case, which was Cummings versus the Board of Education out of Georgia, which one of those first cases that said that the rights of African American students could be denied in favor of other decisions that the school board could take. Hmm. So this is significant that he was able to get this kind of ruling out of the Michigan Supreme Court. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in Michigan, Justice Morris, was a general in the Union Army, and he led the colored troops during the war. And after the decision was issued, he wrote a private letter to Straker in which he said, in underscoring the prose, the beautiful prose that he wrote in his opinion, says, having watched colored troops die so gallantly for a nation that had guaranteed them nothing, I could not help but find that they were entitled to the same rights as any white man in the country.
Those are powerful words. And I know after this landmark case, William Ferguson went on, made more history at the state capitol. He became the first African-American to serve in Michigan's legislature. So, Kimberly, what did DeAugustus Straker do following this case?
Well, following this case, DeAugustus Straker, he did become the first African-American jurist in the state of Michigan, which was also significant. He served two terms as Wayne County Circuit Court Commissioner. He was very active in the political arena, in the civil rights arena, even collaborating with individuals such as W.E.B. Du Bois.
Mm. Kimberly, you're the president of the DeAugustus Straker Bar Association. What's the mission of the group?
So the mission of our bar association is to increase minority representation in the legal profession, supporting and encouraging legal practice opportunities for minorities, and also facilitating equal justice for underserved members of our community, specifically the Oakland County community in which our Bar Association is based.
Kimberly Ann Ward is president of the DeAugustus Straker Bar Association, and Judge Terrence A. Keith sits on the Wayne County Probate Court, sharing the story of attorney DeAugustus Straker and his landmark civil rights case in Michigan, Ferguson v. Guise, decided on October 10th, 1890. Thank you so much for being part of our Michigan History Center segment. It's great talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
The tipless restaurant trend is spreading in Southeast Michigan. This is where restaurant employees get a salary and you, the customer, do not leave a tip. Here's Brad Greenhill, owner of the new tipless restaurant Magnet in Detroit. He says the tipless model focuses and strengthens the business.
It puts a lot more burden on the restaurant. You know, you're essentially under a tip model. The front of house staff doesn't really work for the restaurant. They actually, if you think about it, work for the people.
That was Detroit restaurateur Brad Greenhill. Detroit Free Press restaurant critic Mark Kurlianchik's been taking a look at this rise in tipless restaurants, and he's back with us now. Mark, you recently wrote a piece about the latest restaurant. This is one in Birmingham, climbing aboard the tipless train. Tell us about that.
That's right. It's a restaurant called La Strada. It's an Italian restaurant. It really was founded as an Italian cafe and bakery, and now they've expanded into a full restaurant. It's a pretty small little space. They really only have room for five full-time servers is kind of what they're going for. And instead of accepting tips, they're converting all of their employees to full-time salaried employees who will draw the servers. Basically, they said that it will start between $60,000 and $75,000 a year. After a year, there will be health benefits. Mm-hmm. They're working out 401k matching. There's vacation involved. And really, Jarko Palusha is the name of the owner. He, you know, he's been in the industry for probably close to 40 years. Mm-hmm. He's an immigrant from Montenegro, and he came to the U.S. in the late 80s and first arrived in New York, where, you know, being a career server was a career. It wasn't something that you know, college students did.
Okay, that you did while you're studying in the back room. So
exactly.
This is where you are a career server. So he comes here to Metro Detroit, and what's he find?
Well, and now particularly with all these restaurants opening, I've done a number of stories about how difficult it is to find trained staff.
Career staff.
Just bodies at some point, actually. Yeah. And he's been very cognizant of the fact that it has become this transitional type of job, and he really wants to bring it back to how it was when he first arrived to the U.S., or how it was in Europe, and how it remains in Europe as a viable career.
But $60,000 to $75,000 a year, you have to ask, is that sustainable?
Well, according to the server that I spoke with at La Strada, mm-hmm. It's actually going to be a pay cut for him. He was making more with tips last year. However, what he likes about it is the stability, because, you know, you could have one week that is, you know, a great week and you've got cash in hand. Yeah. And then the next week is slow. There's a holiday or something and, you know, you're struggling. So there's a little bit more predictability, stability that it sounds like some like. Now, this is a very controversial topic. I posted the story on my Facebook page. And
what kind of response did you get?
You know, I mean, it's mixed. It's certainly mixed. There are a lot of servers who say that they would never support anything like this. They wouldn't go to it because particularly in a fine dining restaurant, $75,000 a year is, you know, you can surpass that pretty pretty easily.
Okay. So that, I think that that might surprise a lot of us listening.
Yeah. I think that this is going to affect, the you know, if this movement takes hold, it's going to affect or improve the lives of a number of the, you know, Coney Island type of places. Yeah. For fine dining, it really depends on where you are on the line because, you know, 60 to 75 is a decent living, but there are plenty of servers in other places that can make more than that.
But you mentioned healthcare.
Correct.
So is that something that is kind of a new card on the table for waitstaff?
It is, and there's a doctor actually in Corktown in Detroit, and it's called I believe it's called Plum Health, and what he does is called it's direct care, which a lot of restaurants are now offering. So it's not health insurance, but it covers your primary visits. So if you're going just to, you know, get some antibiotics or for your annual physical, that's covered. Restaurants are covering that, and he's working directly with restaurants to offer deals to them to allow them to pass that on to their employees.
We just talked about direct primary care this very week on Stateside, so
yeah.
That idea. But for those who are not able to access that, I think maybe having a somewhat lower salary, but knowing that they might have health benefits.
Health benefits, even time off, vacation time is something that you don't find in the restaurant industry very often.
So what are customers going to notice as far as the prices of items on the menu? The cost has to be borne somehow.
Sure. At a place like La Strada, you know, Jarco is saying that he's going to keep prices about where they are. I have a feeling that they'll probably go up, you know, at least 10, 15, 20%. There's another restaurant called Magnet that just opened in Core City in Detroit. And all the prices are, it's the same idea where everyone is, they don't call it a salary, they're paid a living wage, but there are no tips. So all that cost of paying your employees a living wage is then is bundled into the cost of your glass of wine or your, you know, there's, and in some ways it's very simple because you don't have to calculate tips at the end. You know, you know what you're paying for, that if this says $20, that's the amount that you're paying for. But some people are just so used to tipping and don't feel comfortable. You know, you almost feel bad if you leave in a tipless restaurant and not give something. So both those places are allowing folks to leave a cash tip if they do, you know, feel so compelled to leave a tip. And that will be pooled among staff and split up between staff evenly.
Yeah, I was wondering how customers feel about that. Are there more places in Southeast Michigan, or are these kind of the brave new world of tipless restaurants?
No, there are a few. Last year, a restaurant called Folk opened in Corktown. It's a little cafe. Their model is slightly different. They just do a flat 18% service charge.
Okay.
So rather, you know, so you have the cost of your food, and then there's a service charge that's put on, you know, whether you're a party of one or a party of six, but no additional tip line. And then Rose's Fine Foods, also on the east side in Detroit, has been doing a form of tipless dining, although there is a tip line that you can give extra on.
Mark, what does all of this say to you about the economics and the realities of running a restaurant?
Well, that they're only getting tougher. You know, the restaurant industry is really, in a lot of ways, is broken. You know, the tipping, too, is a peculiar, really American custom that has its roots in the Jim Crow era and roots in racism. There have been a number of studies done, too. You can look up studies by Cornell University that tipping, actually, discrimination is kind of baked into the tipping model because, you know, people come to it with all their prejudices. So you find that women, and particularly people of color, actually get tipped less than white men. So this is also kind of, you know, equity and inclusion have been big conversation pieces in the restaurant world. And this is one way to attack it. In addition to trying to find, you know, to get more people into the business and to make a viable living off of it.
Interesting. What does the Michigan Restaurant and Lodging Association think of this?
Well, they're not fans of it. You know, the Michigan Restaurant and Lodging Association has, I don't know if you recall, but last year it was on the ballot that it would require, it would be the $15 minimum wage. They would get rid of the tip credit, which allows us to pay, you know, that allows restaurant owners to pay their front of house staffers. It's something like $3. And I don't remember the exact amount, but it's much lower than the state minimum wage because they make tips, and they have vehemently opposed that as well as a paid sick leave for restaurant employees.
And of course, we saw all of that scuttled in lame duck by the state legislature. Is there any? Are you hearing any inklings of whether there'll be another push to try to get that question back on the ballot?
Well, I believe that that's playing out in the courts still. Okay. So I don't think it's going to come on the ballot, but you know, it's making its way through appeals.
Bottom line, what I'm hearing is as you say, the model is kind of broken here, and it seems to be in search of shoring up.
And that is my perspective. Yeah. To be clear, I think that there are plenty of owners and restaurant employees who say everything's great. I love my tips. I love the way that I'm paid out. But the way that we do things here is really we as consumers mm-hmm. are paying the wages at these restaurants through tips, rather than the employees being able to draw a living wage through the restaurant and know that they're going to have that stability and be paid for the work that they are worth.
And the fact that you have been reporting on some recent restaurant closings, as you say, it's a tough business.
It's a tough business, and all this is driving labor costs up. So it's only making it tougher.
Mark Kurlianchik, Detroit Free Press restaurant critic. I always love talking food and restaurants with you. Thank you so much.
It's always a pleasure.
Coming up, a new research and training center at the University of Michigan will be helping schools to prevent violence and shootings. We'll talk with one of the lead researchers and a mother who lost her child in the school shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary. That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Making our schools safer by offering the training and support to prevent school violence. That's the focus of a brand new National Research and Training Center on School Safety. This $6 million national center is housed within the University of Michigan School of Public Health. Experts and researchers in a wide range of areas and people from across the country will be able to join together to offer free safety training and best practices to schools across the nation. Justin Heinze is co-director of the new center. He's an assistant professor of health behavior and health and education at the U of M School of Public Health. And one of the key partners of this new national center is the Sandy Hook Promise Foundation. Its co-founder and managing director is Nicole Hockley. And welcome to both of you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Nicole, how big a problem do you see of gun violence in our nation's schools?
Well, I think it's important to remember that schools are still one of the safest places to be in a community. But as we all know, they're not immune to gun violence or other indicators of violence. You know, everything from bullying and substance abuse, dating violence, all the way up to suicide and homicide. So we do have an issue with gun violence. We obviously, last year was the highest year on record for school shootings in our country. We have something to do, but I do want to ensure that kids know that they are mostly safe at school, but there are always going to be behaviors and watchouts that we need to be careful of. And that's where these violence prevention trainings and notification technology trainings can help to keep kids even feeling safer than they already do.
So, Justin, tell us the mission in this new national center. How is it rising to the challenges that Nicole just expressed?
So we're trying to engage with schools across the spectrum, and that includes urban schools, rural schools, tribal schools, and across the developmental spectrum as well. So we're interested in elementary schools, middle schools, and high schools, where you see different forms of violence manifesting at different times. So dating violence, as Nicole alluded to. School shootings and firearm violence is going to be an issue across all schools. But finding the unique challenges of different bodies, different school partners, and helping them to address their specific challenges.
And you'll be doing training. You'll be doing research and sharing all of that with schools across the country.
That's it. Yeah, that's the plan.
Nicole, you were thrust into the cause of preventing gun violence when your son Dylan died on December 14th, 2012 at Sandy Hook Elementary, one of the 27 lives lost. For people who maybe just have a kind of a tangential awareness of Sandy Hook Promise, tell us how mm-hmm. this center and this effort squares with the mission of Sandy Hook Promise.
Yes, the mission of Sandy Hook Promise is simply to ensure and deliver a future where no student ever experiences the devastation of a school shooting, whether it's direct experience or the ripple effects of tragedies as these go across the country. We know the pain that this causes families and individuals and schools, and our mission is to prevent it by teaching people how to recognize signs and signals and then take actions that deliver interventions so that so that someone gets help long before they ever reach the point of no return or of self-harm.
Justin, who will be in the tent? What kind of experts, what kind of brain power will be part of this effort?
It's really exciting. So we have academic experts, we have foundations on boards and associations, we have an advisory board that includes security professionals, schools, principals, superintendents, we have tribal representation, urban and rural schools, we have students themselves. So all folks coming together with an interest in promoting against school safety and bringing in their unique perspectives, because we're not a one-size-fits-all model. We are going to be working directly with individual schools looking at their unique context. So we need all those voices around the table. Health professionals, criminologists, all those different voices that can help us implement with the best fidelity.
Would we say the main focus is early detection and prevention of gun violence? Is it helping schools develop best practices in the event of an active shooter situation, or all of the above?
It is absolutely all of the above. So we are thinking about upstream preventative programming. We're also talking about what to do in crisis situations. Nicole referenced reporting strategies to preempt any major event. So we are really trying to cover all these different areas. And again, touching on things from the student level up to the district level, and even to a certain extent, the policy level too.
And you're going to be addressing, as you say, the differing situations of urban schools and suburban and rural and tribal. And how will low-income districts be able to access your help?
So all of the training and technical assistance that we will provide will be absolutely free. So we will have in-person training opportunities, we'll have conferences, we'll have online resources available, we'll have a massive open online course. You'll have a way to contact our center to reach out to experts with specific questions. So any sort of media that you can think of, we are going to try to make some of these materials available through it.
Research tells us that in 2015, there were 15 shootings in K-12 schools, and this year that number is at 97. Why are we going in the wrong direction, Nicole?
I wish I had the absolute answer to that question. I think it's a very complex issue. It's a very multifaceted issue, but certainly there are ways to prevent it. We know that people give off signs and signals before they commit an act of violence, and the more that we can train people what to look for and how to intervene, you know, we will reach our goal of significantly reducing or erasing that number.
Justin, what do you want to say about that?
I think it's important, as Nicole is saying, that we have multiple facets, multiple strategies, because gun violence can be an active shooter. Gun violence can be self-harm. And so as we think about the many ways that violence can impact our students and the families around students, we are trying to find ways to intervene at all those different levels. And I do think it's important that we are implementing best practices, or at least something that has evidence to inform or promote its use.
December 14th, 2012, God knows, changed your life, Nicole. And that day, it is seen as a watershed moment in our national conversation about gun rights and gun violence. What happened on that day and since? What is it? It tells us something about ourselves. What is that, do you think?
I think this is really, everything that's happened since Sandy Hook has really been a lot of conversations, a lot of movement, a lot of community-based movement, but also some state and federal movement. And this is a conversation that more people are engaged in now than they were back in 2012 before Sandy Hook. So we're seeing this desire for solutions grow. We're seeing the ideas that come forward continue to increase. People want their kids to be safe. Everyone wants kids to be safe. So this is something that we can all agree on. And now it's just coming up with, as Justin said, best practices, evidence-based information to help ensure that we're doing that. So it's encouraging that we've made more progress than I think people give a lot of credit for around the country in getting to solution mode for curbing this epidemic.
I think when you kind of look at the national discourse, you see, for example, what happened after Parkland and young people across the country walking out and speaking out. I think a lot of people thought Sandy Hook would be the moment that moved our country toward making real substantive progress on gun violence. But I think to a lot of people, there's plenty of thoughts and prayers, but no substantive action.
Yeah, well, I think that's a little bit false, but I think a lot of people aren't totally aware of all the movement. It takes time to build a movement. You don't change the behavior of a country in a year. Because this is about belief systems. This is about the way we are with each other and what we do. And social change takes time. So everything has changed since Sandy Hook. It's perhaps on a slower timeline than I would like and that a lot of other people would like, but it has been incremental change, and that is progress towards the bigger changes that we need to do. The youth movement, I mean, part of the reason why we have been focusing our programs in schools for the last 7 years is because you need those youth voices. That's how you create behavioral change year on year, sustaining these behaviors and this knowledge with kids so that they know what to do and what to look for and make those changes. This is how it happens. And then those kids grow up. It's kind of like, you know, I'm in my late 40s. I grew up learning about designated drivers. And then that created the behavioral change that now as an adult, you know, people don't think about drinking and driving. It still exists sometimes, but more and more people instead immediately go to having a designated driver. These are some of the programs teaching those kids how to be. That's creating significant change. It's not just about policy change. It's about how we pair that with community-based solutions, and that's where we've seen the biggest progress.
Justin, how will this new center address the politics of any conversation about guns in schools? For example, the debate over arming teachers and school staff, for example.
So we can avoid a lot of that debate because our interest is in promoting safety. We are, again, looking for ways that we can improve students' experiences, and we will consider the many ways that you could intervene. Unfortunately, when we think about some policies, for example, arming teachers, when we think about even active shooter drills, at this point, there's just not the evidence base to suggest one way or the other that we should be doing these programs. So we will be, one of the things we will be looking to do is to speak to schools across the country to figure out what are you doing, to try to document what where some of these efforts are happening, and then see how well, again, they align with some of this research that supports their inaction or not.
So I just heard you say active student drills. Is there really nothing to support whether they're making a real difference?
At least from an evidence-based mm-hmm. perspective, it's not there yet. And I also think about the consequences when you implement an activity like that. I have been through an active shooter drill, and it can be a little intimidating. And if you think about that, there are potentially psychological consequences when students feel like their building is not safe, and these are constant reminders. At the same time, you do want students to know what to do in a crisis situation. So for us, it's really trying to understand, is there some sort of evidence that we can point to that this is a good idea, that it should be implemented as widely as it seems to be, as seems to be happening? And then certainly, how can we help schools to do it well?
So over this next 3 years of this grant from the Department of Justice, you're going to be doing training. You're going to train schools across the country. You're going to be doing research. So let's say we're sitting down, the three of us, and talking in 3 years. How do you want this new National Center at U of M to have made a difference and saved lives in this country, Nicole?
I think the more that we can educate schools on what are the best programs for them to be putting in place, then we'll see more impact in terms of good processes, good programs, good training, and the impact that comes from that, rather than people either spending their money on non-evidence-based solutions that there might be band-aids but don't achieve anything or that don't help the students long-term. So this is about really providing something proper and evidence-based rather than just gut feel.
And I would hope that we can look to our school partners and they can say we have helped them tailor their response to school safety concerns that in a way that fits their context. And what I think is really important is that they can sustain these efforts once we are gone. You interact with us, you get to engage with some of our materials, but how can we sustain those efforts? Have we built some of that capacity within mm-hmm. schools that they can teach others or teach themselves as they move forward, and that this movement really keeps moving, gaining steam?
And we want to remind everyone you can learn more about Sandy Hook Promise. They've got a terrific website, and you can learn a lot by going to sandyhookpromise.org. We have been talking with Nicole Hockley, who is the co-founder and managing director of Sandy Hook Promise, and Justin Heinze, who's co-director of this new University of Michigan National Center for School Safety and Gun Violence Prevention. Pleasure to talk with both of you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Ask just about any kid, what's your favorite subject in school? And a good chance the answer will be recess. But in many schools, that kind of unstructured outdoor play is being cut down or eliminated altogether. And after school, kids' time is increasingly structured with music lessons, sports, and tutoring and other activities. And that means less room for free play, no plan, minimal adult supervision in their day-to-day lives. What does this mean in the classroom? Well, with us now is Michigan Radio's education commentator, Hall of Fame teacher, Matinga Ragatz. Matinga, how does play look different at school than it did, say, 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm old enough to remember the days where, like, playground politics were allowed to play out, you know. So, but nowadays, it's very structured. Kids are not able to make the rules of the playground, and they basically are existing with adult rules in a kid's world. So it's very, very different for them.
So is it a matter of there's not recess time, or when there is recess time, you've got playground monitors watching and like a hawk?
I think it's a combination of both. You know, you want to trim the recess time, and then all there's always the playground mom, and the kids have to play in a certain way that is not natural to them.
What impact does this reduced time outside and not enough unstructured play, what does that have on what happens inside the classroom?
Well, we're talking about two things here. We're talking about, for example, playing outdoors and then this unstructured autonomous time. So now we know that nature is a multivitamin. We know that just being out in the sun and the smells and the air and just getting mucky and dirty with the mud, there is some health benefits to that. So depriving the kids from doing that is producing kids that, you know, we're actually not allowing them to grow up in a healthy way. So that, you know, obesity and diabetes and all of these things. Also, the fact that the kids don't have autonomous time leads to a sort of like a mental fatigue, which really makes it difficult for them to make good decisions when the going gets tough and it's a stressful time. So by allowing them to play outside, they're healthier. And then by allowing them to play unstructured in a structured way makes them a lot, like mentally, a lot more ready to focus in class.
We recently talked about the importance of after-school programs and activities that can enrich a child and lend some structure to a student's day. How do you create the right balance of the structured activities to the unstructured free play?
You know, the more time we spend as educators trying to structure activities for school so that the kids behave better, the more energy we have to spend trying to get them to behave. And I just always think about, like, you know, if you think about a cat and that languid, that graceful creature, and now think about that cat in the box and try to teach that cat tricks in the box. And that's basically the situation that we're creating, because if you've ever seen a third grader walk from point A to point B, he's moving every part of his body, but then we put him in the classroom and he has to behave a certain way.
So when you think about the pressure of testing, the content that has to be covered, are there ways that teachers can incorporate some more unstructured playtime into the classroom?
Yes, you know, and especially nowadays that teachers are going to the research and looking at the research for solutions rather than policy. And so a lot of teachers are using that discovery, that effortless play that the kids have, and turn it into a discover activity so that the kids can then focus in class. For example, say you have the kids and they have to write something about, you know, being at the lake or running in the pool.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a fantastic way to get them to do that is to put the sprinklers outside and the slip and slide, have them running around for 20 minutes, and then now they have the field experience to come in and write a better essay.
But they're
that
all wet.
Kind of thing. there's lots of clothing. You just change your clothing, come in, but now you have a healthier kid. Yeah. They've worked out all their issues and their kinks, and they sit down and they can talk about chattering teeth and goose pimples in their arms and things like that. So it makes it so that they're a better writer.
So how does a teacher make that pitch to administrators, to the principal and to the administrator, like, we want to go out and do the slip and slide?
I think when administrators start seeing solutions, they're not going to ask how you got there. So a lot of the teachers that are trying them out are finding their kids are a lot more focused, and they're just getting a lot better solutions with their efforts.
What about parents who are thinking about college apps and future jobs and test scores? How do you convince them that letting kids just hang out and be is a good thing?
You know, I'm not going to tell you how to raise your kids, but it's all about balance, you know. And when you have an outdoor kid, you have a much more intuitive kid. So I'm going to tell parents, don't forget to raise that kid as well.
Matinga Ragatz, Michigan Radio's education commentator. Thanks, Matinga.
Thank you, Cindy.
Tomorrow on Stateside, community colleges received a slight bump in state funding this year, but is it enough? We'll talk about the value of community college in our state tomorrow. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.